Okay, good.
Get rid of the commissioners. I said we did literally 8 years.
House Committee on Revenue for May 13th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues and those on the internet and in our audience, I want you to know that we're not ready on House Bill 2150. The amendment is not finished, nor do we have the fiscal. So that will be moved to Monday. And we are going to open a public hearing on the Brownfield bills. House Bill 2289 and House Bill 2734. We'll open that public hearing. Mazin, you want to give us an update? And then somebody's got a sign out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Brownfields issues, it seems at least one of them, House Bill 2734, this comes to you. You're the third committee to hear this bill. And I think Metro and the advocates for the committee has gone third time to do it. They got so good about doing it that they can't wait until they tell you about it and perfect the presentation this time. And they have also presentation on PowerPoint for that too. So they would address both bills, and then we can talk them take them one at a time, Mr. Chair.
Great. Representative Reed, did you want to be heard on this one?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to just make a couple comments.
Please.
With your permission, and I might suggest they could come up while they get settled.
Randy Tucker, Seth Otto, and David, is it Robbins?
Ravine,
thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, committee members, this issue of Brownfields is one I've spent some time on. In previous sessions, Representative Benson and I worked together on the Transportation and Economic Development Committee. One of the things we observed is the really common occurrence of brownfields all over the state, all kinds of different settings, urban and rural and suburban, and how much potential is kind of bottled up in those pieces of land and what might happen but doesn't as a result of that. In the last session, we thought we had an idea, and you and I have talked about it, that was aimed at the fact that a lot of these properties just kind of sit and don't, the incentives are not lined up for much of anything to happen with them. It turns out, as do many things with property taxes, that was more complicated and constrained than we hoped. But I think the momentum that was established as a result of that work continues, and the folks that are here today have done great work continuing that conversation and have some good concepts that are with us. And as we talk about the specifics of it, I hope the committee will keep in mind what initially attracted me to the concept that there are these places that could do great things around the state if we can just get them over this kind of this obstacle. So thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Gentlemen, if you'll state your name for the record and then give your testimony, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, but I'm really here today representing the Brownfields Coalition. And the reason I'm doing it is because some of my colleagues at Metro, after the work we did last session that Representative Reed just mentioned, began to talk to other parties around the state, and eventually, through a sort of an organic process, the Brownfields Coalition came together. And my colleagues have been the coordinators and facilitators of that process, and so I have the honor of addressing you here and helping to work on this issue with a really great coalition. And so I want to call your attention to two pieces of material that I've submitted for the record. One is this one-pager. This is the Brownfield Coalition's sort of summary of what we are, what we're doing. One of the key things to look at on that is this gray bar down the left side of the page, which lists the members of the Brownfield Coalition. And there are a number of members of the coalition represented here today. Maybe they could all just kind of raise their hand for a second. And obviously there are many of the people that you see on a regular basis in this building, and then there are many entities from outside this building. The coalition has a broad range that of members, including business organizations, environmental groups, housing advocates, local governments, lots of different kinds of groups, community advocates have been involved. And one of the reasons it has such a wide range of members is that there's such a wide range of brownfields in this state. There are a lot of different typologies of brownfields, from small corner gas stations and dry cleaners to areas that could be used for residential use in the future, to large industrial sites. They're in urban areas, they're in rural areas, and they're in all areas of the state. And so on that note, I'd like to draw your attention to the other piece of material that I've handed in, which is this piece. Now, this is a piece that is from Business Oregon. And I want to note for the record that Business Oregon does not have a position on this bill, but this is a great background piece to show you the extent of the problem. And if you go to the back page that's kind of folded up and open it up, you'll see a map like this. It shows that gives you an idea that this really is a statewide – sorry. This really is a statewide problem. There are brownfields in virtually every community in the state. There are thousands of them around the state. And that's another reason why this coalition has come together and is as energized as it is. During the course of the last year, the way we came up with the proposals that we brought to the legislature was through a lot of conversations where there were many other proposals that were put on the table. And the real filtering questions were which of these proposals would have the most impact, the most benefit, and which of these proposals have the greatest political feasibility. And at least one proposal where the political feasibility isn't as high, but the impact was very high, has snuck into our agenda. And I'll mention that in a minute. But we really tried to concentrate up in that quadrant of the matrix that is high feasibility and high impact. The other thing to say about brownfields is, there's not one single tool that is going to solve the brownfields problem, and there is not one single tool that is even useful on all brownfields. And there are some brownfields that probably will never be cleaned up, and there are other brownfields that don't really need any help. So we have sort of a triage situation where there are places where cleanup and redevelopment will probably pencil out. Maybe there's a little bit of time needed to get to that point, but it doesn't really need a lot of help. There are places where almost nothing we can do will help. It's those sites in the middle that are close to feasibility but not quite there. Those are the ones that we need to target in the state, because those are where state assistance and local assistance can make a difference. So that said, let me tell you what we're going to do today. So Seth Otto, to my right, will give you a presentation. Seth has done a couple of studies of various tools, including one for Metro, and he'll tell you about that. And he has analyzed the tools that essentially, generic versions of the tools that are before you today in specific form. Then David Rubino, to my left, and I will talk to you about the specific bills, if that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Seth Otto. I'm with the consulting firm Malfoster & Alonji. We're an environmental consulting firm based in Portland, specializing in environmental remediation, cleanup, and redevelopment. I've been asked to come here and present a little bit of the work that we've done over the past 3 years for various different agencies around the state, both for Metro, City of Portland, Business Oregon, and the Brownfield Coalition. And I'll go over this in a broad way, and if you have questions, ask for more detail. These studies are also available. Randy can provide them, and they're on the web as well. So as Randy mentioned, brownfields are everywhere. This map is now probably pretty familiar to you. These are all of the sites that DEQ is tracking, so 13,000 sites in their environmental cleanup site inventory and their leaking underground storage tank program. They follow closely with our pattern of urban growth in the state, transportation corridors, and they're essentially where you'd expect them to be, but they are in every county, in every district of the state. It's important to note that it's not just a Portland problem, as I think there's a perception sometimes. Of the 5,000 sites in the cleanup inventory, only 800 of them are in Portland. And it's also important to note that many of these sites are unresolved. Of the 1,500 that have, I'm sorry, of the 5,000 sites, approximately a third have a no further action determination. So there's many unresolved issues out there associated with these sites. It's also a growing issue. This is from a study that was completed in 2010 by a colleague of mine. At that time, there were just shy of 5,000 sites in the cleanup inventory in the cleanup program. And the rate of new sites being discovered and entered into the program exceeded the rate of closure, of issuance of no further action letters. You can see a growing delta there between sites that are being discovered, sites that are being managed and closed. In 2012, we worked for Metro on a project that examined the scale and impact of brownfield properties in the Metro area. We studied 2,300 sites, approximately 6,300 acres, and we developed a methodology to extrapolate out from these sites, from the known sites and acreage, how much potential brownfield acreage there is, and we found that there's approximately 60% more in the Metro area. Last year, we completed a study for the Brownfield Coalition where we came to a similar conclusion that around the state there is between 50 and 60% more brownfields than are currently known. So it's an issue that is really going to be continuing to vex our communities. In 2013, we completed a study for the City of Portland that focused on the impact of brownfield and environmental contamination issues on the availability of industrial land. This is an issue I'm sure you're aware of, the lack of available large lot industrial property in the city. And we found that cleanup and remediation of brownfield properties in the city of Portland could help them meet approximately three-quarters of their industrial land need over the planning horizon. So that's a little bit of the context. I think the question then is, why should the state intervene? Why should the state and local jurisdictions create programs to incentivize brownfield redevelopment? And I'll go over some of what we found as the return on public investment from public investment. Last year, we, on behalf of Business Oregon, evaluated in a look-back analysis the impact of the state brownfield programs that are managed both by Business Oregon as well as DEQ and the Oregon Health Authority. And we found that over the 23 years that these programs have been operating, for every $1 of state investment in brownfield cleanup, there was leveraged another $116. And that's primarily private investment. It's important to note that's primarily private investment. So a little bit of public investment can really harness a great deal of private investment in redevelopment of these properties. And these funds that have been invested by the state have generated approximately 8,900 jobs over that time frame. A little bit more detail here. Again, of the 2,600 acres that are directly of brownfield redevelopment that are directly attributable to the state programs, we've seen about 68,000 direct jobs, annual property taxes in the area of $57 million, and state income taxes of almost $100 million. For the Metro study, we evaluated some very specific tools that are used around the country in various different states and jurisdictions, kind of the best practices for incenting brownfield redevelopment. They included the remediation tax credit, the property tax abatement, a state cleanup fund, and a brownfield land bank. And I'll go through quickly what we found in return in the Metro area. So for every $1 million invested, we saw a very substantial and quick return on that investment in property tax and personal income tax generated. So this is, in this slide, a remediation tax credit, personal income tax credit provided to developers of brownfield redevelopment to cover 50% of the remediation cost. In Portland, we also found a similar excellent return on investment. Of the tools that we looked at, this one rose to the top, 10-to-1 return on public investment there. in Metro, looking at property tax abatement and land bank. Again, these are the ones in 2734. We found as well substantial return on investment over a short period of time for both of these. So what are the implications of this? What did we learn, and what are the big takeaways? And you know, Randy went over this very well already, but I'll just hammer in on these points, that there's no single policy incentive that will be sufficient to catalyze the redevelopment of the brownfields in this state. You need a package of tools. They need to work together and complement each other, and that's what these bills propose or start to propose. Direct public investments, or sorry, policies that leverage private resources typically have higher financial return on investment, and that's what we've seen in our analysis. So tax incentives in particular bring investment to the table. Direct public investments have the potential to target and support challenged properties. So for those intractable long-term issues, something like a land bank really provides that patient capital potentially and patient public oversight. Tax incentives tend to support projects that are close to financial feasibility. This is what Randy said as well. We're not talking about giving money to developers and property owners that already have a market for their property, that already have a use. These are those properties that, without a little bit of incentive, will remain underutilized and not realizing their potential. So that's it, very quickly. And I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Let's do the rest of the presentation, then we'll take questions all at once.
I'm going to jump back in again for a second, Mr.
Please.
Chair, and then so there are two bills before you. House Bill 2289 is the one that creates a state tax credit for brownfields. Mr. Chair, you and I had a conversation earlier today. I think I know what the prospects of this bill are, but we did want to bring this to you because even though it's a bit aspirational, we understand that many tax credits are sunsetting this year and that resources are limited in order to renew even the existing tax credits. We also know that we'll hear more tomorrow morning about what kind of resources are available. But that said, as Seth just presented, the tax credit, according to the analysis that has been done, shows a very quick return on investment. It's one of the most powerful tools that is potentially available. The bill before you, 2289, provides for up to a $500,000 tax credit, which would be capped at 50% of eligible cleanup costs for a site. The site would have to have the cleanup costs would have to exceed 25% of the assessed value of the site to qualify. There are some options for increasing the percentage of costs that could be covered by the tax credit. There's a cap on the total amount of tax credit the state would offer in a given year. And I'd be happy to try to answer any more questions about that if you have more questions. But I wanted to at least make sure that that's on the record. We obviously would appreciate your consideration of that, and we also will continue to try to do more analysis of the impact of a tool like that in areas outside the Portland area. House Bill 2734 is the so-called local tools bill. This is a bill that doesn't cost the state any money, or at least doesn't seem to. It doesn't require anyone to do anything. It authorizes local governments at their option to use their own resources to support economic development and community revitalization and environmental remediation in their communities. As Mazen noted at the beginning, this bill has already been through two previous committees, the Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee and the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. The bill has two distinct pieces, neither of which depends on the other. And one is authority to create land banks, and the other is a property tax mechanism. So what I'd like to do is ask David to present the land bank piece, and then I'll talk a little bit about the property tax piece.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is David Rubino. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Tonkin Torp in Portland. I work in the Environment and Natural Resources Practice Group. I'm testifying here on my own behalf. I've been an active member of the Brownfields Coalition I'm not here on behalf of any particular client, though. I've been an environmental practitioner for almost 24, 25 years at this point, the first 12 of which were with the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and the last 12-plus I've been in private practice. In that capacity, I've represented the federal government on brownfields transactions. I've represented municipal governments. I've represented private entities. I feel fairly passionate about brownfield redevelopment. I think it's a vital area that needs to be addressed. Brownfields are a problem in every community. I'm not going to repeat. They present a health hazard to neighbors. They create dead zones in many areas, particularly urban areas, and they negatively impact adjoining property owners. And that can potentially grow as the year goes by, as years go by. So you can have a particular property that has problems and isn't going anywhere. The adjacent properties see their values drop a little bit. That continues to spiral out as they try and sell and you don't have takers. So it's not a localized problem. The fact, if you could just address the particular brownfield itself and think that that takes care of everything, that would be great if that were the case. But unfortunately, brownfields have a broader impact than just a particular property. As been mentioned, there are current tools. There are prospective purchaser agreements. There are no further action letters. Those both require time and money. In order to obtain those, you have to negotiate them with either the federal or the state agencies that you wish to get them from. They require you to bring lawyers into the picture. They require you to bring consultants into the picture. They can be very helpful for some, but they're not always helpful for all. Currently, though, there's almost no tool that is specifically dedicated to giving local government authorities options to try and tackle these problems on their own. They don't negotiate PPAs. They don't negotiate no further actions letters. They can't issue those. The land bank provision is designed to give the local governments the ability to try and take these problems on for properties that are within their jurisdiction. I won't go into the Brownfield Coalition beyond saying that it is a very, very broad-based group. It has representatives of environmental and community groups, private industry, governmental entities, local governmental entities. And this is a byproduct of all the discussions that have gone on in that coalition. So what exactly is a land bank? A land bank is, it allows a local government to set up a separate legal entity to acquire, hold, dispose, rent, lease, redevelop, remediate property. The problem for most governmental entities is if they try and acquire the property themselves, they essentially buy into liability for the property as an owner. The only way they get around that is if they have to exercise eminent domain. So in the ordinary course, they're not going to do that, and they have properties they would otherwise like to bring back into productive use that could be used in the overall comprehensive development, but they themselves can't acquire it without exposing themselves to liability. The land bank gives them a separate legal entity that can take that responsibility on. The land bank itself, the purpose is to acquire, rehabilitate, and reutilize real property impacted by hazardous substances. And as was mentioned by Mr. Otto, it allows for a patient capital holder. They can acquire the property. There's no requirement for them to immediately turn it, flip it, do anything. But what they can do is begin to consolidate the ownership so that when the right development opportunity comes around, the developer is talking to an entity that is interested in getting the development done. They can buy, they can sell, they can lease, they can repair, they can rehabilitate, they can even remediate the property. Part of the statute will allow them to seek cost recovery for the cost they expend in doing remediation, which is key. In addition, they don't walk into liability because they will be exempt from owner liability as long as they just simply acquire the property. If they do any acts of their own, that wouldn't give them the exemption, but the actual act of acquiring the property and just holding it will not expose them to liability under state law. And that's a critical, critical component to allow for the acquisition and consolidation of those properties. Land banks, however, may not exercise eminent domain. There will be no land grab essentially authorized, nor are they permitted under the bill to acquire property outside of the jurisdiction in which they're created. So again, this is meant to be a local government option and to address local governmental properties within the locality. It's designed to be local control. The board will be made up of representatives of local agencies, school boards, county and city councils, community representation. The goal is to have full community representation on the land bank board of directors. It's a public body for the purposes of record inspection, and they would provide and prepare annual reports of their activities, which would be available to the public to review. As I mentioned, one of the key components is the liability limitation. They would not, simply by the act of acquiring property, become liable under state law. My experience is that is a critical component in getting these properties acquired and into the hands of an entity that truly has a desire to bring them back into productive use. I would strongly encourage the passage of House Bill 2734, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that anybody may have about it at the conclusion of Mr. Tucker's testimony.
So this is the last leg of our panel. So I'm here to talk. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the second half of this bill. In the B engrossed version of the bill, it has a heading that says property tax abatement. And actually, before I get into that, let me say also that, first of all, this has been the hardest part of the bill to draft. We're sort of in our third iteration, third different mechanism to try to get this right. And just got some draft language out of Ledge Council the other day. I'm still working through it to make sure we can get this cleaned up. I know that the time is short. And I just want to also mention before I get into it that there are, for some questions you might have, there are staff here from the Department of Revenue and also from Business Oregon that may be able to answer questions you may have. So back to what the mechanism is. So we came into this looking to create a local option tax abatement, as Seth discussed. We early on learned that Oregon doesn't do what we had envisioned as a coalition, which was essentially it came out, it operated sort of like a credit against property taxes. So we approached the tax assessors and discussed with them how best to achieve what we were trying to achieve. And a second mechanism was proposed, and that's the mechanism that's actually in the B engrossed version of the bill, but it's a pretty complicated scheme, and having vetted it more fully and having circulated it more broadly, I think there was general consensus this wasn't the way to go either. So in numerous conversations, the mechanism that we have settled upon is a special assessment, and you as the Revenue Committee may know a lot more than I do about special assessments. Let me just attempt to explain it very, very briefly. There's an existing administrative rule on the valuation of contaminated property that allows a property owner to bring to the county assessors estimates of the cost to clean up a site and to get the taxable value reduced by that cost. So if you've got a site that, if it were clean, would be worth $100,000, but you've got $50,000 of cleanup that's required, really no one's going to pay you more than $50,000 for that property. That is the real market value, $50,000, even though a clean property would be worth more. So there's a mechanism now for adjusting the assessed value and actually the real market value of your property based on cleanup costs. Okay, so going into this process, you would do that first. Then you'd be able to, if your local government has adopted an ordinance to establish this special assessment, you would be able to freeze the taxable value of your property at that level for a period of X number of years. Right now the draft says up to 10 years, but that number would also be a local option. And while you clean the property up and potentially redevelop the property. And so, essentially, that's the tax benefit that you would receive. Again, it's a local option from the local government would have control of. So the significant difference between the B engrossed bill that you have and the bill that we will bring to you, hopefully in the next week or so, is the different mechanism. Other smaller differences, we're going to limit this mechanism to cities, counties, and ports. It just seemed like any local government was a little bit too broad for a mechanism like this. We're going to provide a little bit more flexibility in the draft of the statute or in the language of the statute, for those local governments so that they'd be able to adopt other provisions and sideboards to such a program as long as they were consistent with the underlying statute, and that they'd be able to apply this they'd be able to apply it to either all of their territory or a part of their territory. Some of the provisions that are in the existing legislation require that any applicant, and these would remain, require that any applicant be working under an agreement with or an order of or a process authorized by DEQ, and that the owner must be in compliance with that process or agreement or order. Any applicants that that themselves had contaminated the property or exacerbated existing contamination or concealed contamination would not be eligible. So these are some of the underlying provisions that are already in the bill. The bill also would give the local government the option of providing additional benefits to landowners that did certain other beneficial actions, whether it was construction of low-income housing or of healthcare facilities in areas that are designated as having unmet health needs, hiring of minority women and emerging small business contractors for the cleanup work, providing parks and open space, et cetera. So that would be, again, a local option to provide an additional benefit. And finally, the tax, no tax reduction, no special assessment would go into effect unless a majority of the, unless jurisdictions representing a majority of the tax base of the rate agree. That is modeled on language that's in other statutes having to do with other special assessments and tax exemptions. Right now, the language we have in the bill authorizes or creates a 75% threshold of approval, it's been suggested to maybe make that consistent with some of the other statutes, which require a 51% threshold of approval. We'd, you know, hear your pleasure on that. And of course, there's a revocation process, et cetera. So these are all sort of the standard elements. But the main thing is to understand that the mechanism that's going to be coming before you next week will be a special assessment, which is, as I described, a sort of a freezing of the property value at the dirty valuation, even as the cleanup occurs for a period of years. So with that, I think I will stop and expose ourselves to your questioning.
Thank you. That's an interesting way of putting it, but it's probably accurate. Okay. They've given you the chance. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yeah. We have what I would consider to be a brownfield in my district that was reclaimed by another business, and it's now in its 10th year of ongoing, monitoring by DEQ, and there has been no indication for any of those 10 years that anything is happening on the site, but the new owners are having to pay DEQ thousands of dollars each year to come in and monitor a site that was already cleaned up. So I was wondering how you take that into consideration on your costs or expenses for your brownfield cleanups. It is not just a one-time thing. Depending on what you have, this is a gas station, and if you're familiar with that.
Yes, Representative Woods. Monitoring, especially long-term monitoring for groundwater sites, is very typical and is a general requirement both state and federally. Depending on what the contaminants were and where they were located, if they were in the groundwater, it's not uncommon for groundwater monitoring to be required for 10, 20, even sometimes as far out as 30 years. It doesn't mean additional active remediation is being required, but it's to ensure that whatever residual has been left is not creating any further health hazards to anybody in the area. That is part and parcel of acquiring a piece of property that has those issues.
And Representative Whitsitt, Chair Barnhart, the language that we're going to be bringing to you does include monitoring as an eligible cost under the proposal. It's something that is accounted for in what we're bringing forward.
Great. That's my concern was the initial cleanup cost is becoming a minor part of the ongoing monitoring of this situation. And so further, I was wondering, if we decide we're going to build homes on this, or apartments, low-income housing, or whatever, how do we deal with that? You know, are certain brownfields going to be eligible for this, but ones that have ongoing monitoring going to be excluded? Or, you know, how are you going to sort through that?
I don't believe that any brownfield per se would be ineligible under the bill. They could all, it would depend on the land bank component. The local government would be given the option of trying to determine priorities of use and use for the for a property they acquire. So they could look to promote residential, mixed use, or industrial if they so desire. Your question strikes me as being somewhat more general in nature than just specific as to the brownfield per se. Under state law, I mean, the end uses and the amount of monitoring that is needed is dictated by the residual risk, and risk levels are different for residential, mixed use, and industrial, with industrial being the least stringent, residential obviously being the most stringent. So monitoring is done to ensure that the exposure pathways are cut off. That would exist for a brownfield property, all brownfield properties, as well as any other property that was or was not a brownfield. So I don't believe this bill would impact that one way or the other.
Great, thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all the hard work on this. The part of the bill that's of greatest interest to me is the part that lists the liability of the entity formed, and so I just was running this through and trying to figure out how it would work. If this corporation was formed and it acquired this property, and then it did so because it knew it would not be liable for the cleanup, why would it clean it up? And I asked the question because, not that you wouldn't, it's just that there's a kind of a major transformation there of value, because the only thing that forces you to clean it up is that fear of that liability. That's why it just sits there. So the big issue here before us today is, are we going to handle the cities, these properties, without that burden? And there's all kinds of other interesting tax issues that go along, but I haven't heard you address it, so please.
I'll do my best to do that, Chairman, Representative Benz. What the bill is designed to do is give initial liability protection. So in other words, the land bank doesn't become exposed to third-party suits or suits by the state directly simply by acquiring the property. In my experience, that has been that's a significant impediment to municipalities and localities acquiring properties they otherwise would like to bring into productive use because the private property owner doesn't elect to do so. There is nothing that would otherwise, though, exempt them from complying with environmental laws and requirements. So if there were monitoring, that would still have to be done. And I would think that the entity, the land bank acquiring the property, would have the incentive to either do the work themselves or to be seeking out a private developer that would do it, or that would do it in partnership with them, because the main goal for them is to bring it back to productive use. Sitting on it doesn't do them a lot of good. So we think the incentive from the bill would be such that it would provide local governments with an opportunity to be more proactive in getting a hold of properties and putting them out there for developers to become interested in, because they essentially have a greater interest in getting the overall comprehensive development performed. You know, does it mandate that they do the cleanup? The bill wouldn't, but they would have to comply with environmental laws while they hold it. So that's a different issue than being forced to do the full cleanup itself. But that would be part and parcel of the overall development and probably the deal that they would ultimately look to strike with whomever does come in to do it. And that entity would not have the exemption from liability. So that would be part of the development cost that would have to be figured out.
Well, yes, please.
Yeah, so if the entity acquires the property, is it going to receive a letter from the DEQ saying, thank God we have someone here now who can finally clean this up, get busy, clean it up? Or does this exemption protect this entity from that kind of demand from DEQ?
I don't believe that DEQ could demand that they clean it up, but if there was monitoring that was going on, I think they'd be required to continue on with the monitoring. I don't believe the bill would require them to clean it up. DEQ would be able to go after the prior property owner or prior entities who are involved in contaminating the property itself in order to get them to do the cleanup.
Right, and of course, in most instances, that path has long since been explored, found wanting, and now we have a orphan property. So, just saying. But the thing that's a secondary interest, once we get past this initial point, is the competitive nature of what's going on, and the creation of land now that didn't used to be available for certain types of uses, but now it's on the market, because by this, I don't want to call it sleight of hand, but by this method. We avoid the necessity of cleaning up, and we can go ahead and develop the property. We know we have a 10-year window, and we know someone's going to have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. But this has opened the door, if you will, for this development. I'm not saying that's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I just hadn't heard you guys explain it in the way I'm now positive to you. And so I really need to have you opine upon it and tell me if I've missed the point completely or what, because I would like to know if we as a government should be involved in creating properties that compete on the market with others that have property of this nature. And maybe it's all for the best, as long as we keep track of how much the government is truly involved. But this handing out of a exemption seems to me to be slightly different. I kind of wish we would hand it out to all kinds of people so they wouldn't, if this is in truth a development type benefit. But anyway, that's my question to you. Is this something that, it sounds like a technique that we should be using more broadly. Why are we limiting it to just the municipality?
Yeah. Well, there are other tools that are available. Pardon me, Mr. Chairman and Representative Benz. My apologies. There are already tools available for private developers to gain the liability protection that they're looking for. They can go through PPAs. They can get no further action letters. So it's not as if tools do not exist for them. This is designed to try and give greater control to the local government, who in some measure becomes the entity of last resort that has to deal with it, whether they actually own the property or not, which is one of the problems that, because if a property is abandoned, whatever is going on, someone's turning to the local government to at least address part of it in terms of even if it's putting up fencing, for example, to keep people out. I don't know if I would view it as providing any type of undue preference. From where I sit, I don't see it that way. I think that it provides local governmental entities an ability to be more proactive to try and bring back into positive and productive use properties within their jurisdiction that the private market otherwise is not, for reasons primarily dealing with the contamination, initially willing to walk in and do itself. There are some properties that they are. And some properties are of such great location that it doesn't matter. Private developers do come in and they do renovate the properties and they take on the cleanup costs as part of the deal. There are some, as was alluded to earlier, that maybe given the level of contamination, there's not very much that could be done for an end use other than to ensure nobody can get into it again. But the properties that are in the range in the middle, after much discussion within the coalition, we believe that this type of program could provide a useful and needed incentive on these properties to local governments to be more proactive. Does that address your question,
Mr. Chair? That's adequate for that question. I have another.
Please,
May I add to that? I apologize for interjecting, Chairman. Thank you, Representative Benz. I just wanted just to clarify and hopefully not belabor the point. It handles the liability. It doesn't clear the obligation to clean up. And there is a final check on this that the private market provides. That's financing. No lending institution will support a development of a property that has an environmental cleanup obligation on it. And so ultimately, it will be required.
I agree with that. And that brings Mr. to my next question. question, and this has to do with the what Representative Wizard remarked upon earlier, which is the incredible cost of these exercises, which is why these properties are still orphan properties. And my concern that this structure is going to be more of a something to point at as opposed to something that actually works. And the reason I say that is because other than lifting the liability or precluding the liability, the other part is premised on the amount of tax avoided under whatever the device may ultimately be as compared to the cost of cleanup. And the cost of cleanup, the cleanups that I have been involved in have been in the millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars. This is a really small, these taxes, particularly when they've been adjusted in the way we're talking, not even a tail wagging the dog. It's so small. And so what I would worry about is if we put this device, this structure in place, is it might be used to pretend that we actually have done something. And not to be harsh, but there's a lot of wishful thinking in this when I think of the cost of cleanup. Because most of the things that could be cleaned up have been cleaned up. And the market values of, you know the whole story. So what we're looking at here are the ones that are really bad. And so I would ask, you guys are the experts, does this little bit of property tax saved, is it in and of itself going to be adequate to drive anything, or is it merely something that's added on in what we call a free ride here? When someone does finally, when the property values around it get high enough to make it all work. So what I'm afraid of is, once again, we've designed something that it's in that big pile of benefits, but it's something that's kind of, and you get this too, as opposed to, and yeah, this should drive though. So your thoughts.
So now you're talking about the property, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, talking about the property tax piece of the bill. I will say that over the last couple of days since we've gotten draft language back from Legislative Council, I've been having similar concerns. It sounds like your concern, if I may, is that the tool is not robust enough. Am I correct? I mean, you made it sound like it's a tiny tail wagging the dog, or I think that was your...
I think you've overstated it. The point is, it's if I may.
Please.
The point is, the property taxes are significant to us that receive them, of course.
Sure.
But as compared to the total value of the property, or in this case, the value of the cleanup, pretty modest number. And so I don't ever see it being the driver of the cleanup. So what I see instead is a mechanism that we can all point at and say, well, we've done something to make these properties viable, when in point of fact they aren't, not by virtue of this one little thing. And so, of course, it's going to take more money. And I don't think this does it. But just to say, well, it's something,
right.
I don't think that does it for me, because that simply means it's an added on thing that people don't, I'm not interested in giving stuff away unless it's actually helping. And how much we're giving away is a question, and we'll have to wait to see
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't think local governments are interested in giving anything away unless it's actually helping either. That's why it would be at their option to adopt a program or not. But also, we were talking before the hearing, and David was commenting about how, some of these, it's a tipping point question. Some of these projects are close, but not quite. And so even if it's a modest tool, in some cases, not certainly in all cases, this is not a panacea, but in some cases it might be the thing that makes something feasible that is not feasible. And I think we are, taking a close look at the mechanism itself over the next couple of days to see if we can make sure that it is in fact something that's worth adopting in the first place.
Mr. Chair, and if I could amplify the response a bit. Years ago, when prospective purchaser agreements were first thought up, people, I believe, had a similar concern of, is it really going to do it? Are people really going to take the government up on essentially this opportunity? And over time, I think they have been proven to be very successful, that people do take advantage of them when they get to understand them and what it can do. And as a program matures, more and more entities use prospective purchaser agreements or seek out no further action letters in order to decide to move forward and acquire property. It's impossible to forecast whether, for instance, the land bank will be that successful or not. My experience, however, is providing the tools, you give them time to see if they work and if they're used, and you can make a determination as to whether or not it is or is not beneficial after a certain period of time. I think most people today would agree that PPAs and no further action letters are very helpful and are worth the time and effort to get. And the financial institutions are very comfortable with what they mean and the limitations that they provide. Obviously, a PPA goes a lot further than no further action letter. But for some financial institutions, depending on what you're doing, that no further action letter may be sufficient. I would put the land bank in the same category. It is, you know, we've given it a lot of thought, and I think people who are involved in the industry perceive it as something that could be a very useful tool. I can't give you a better answer today about whether or not it will be, but I think time gets to tell that. So if we, if you all see fit to pass it, that would be a question to revisit in a few years when local governments have had the opportunity to get comfortable with it, see if they get formed, and then see how well the land banks themselves do at picking the right properties to buy, handling them properly, getting them back into productive use.
Representative Leninger, please.
Thank you. Thank you for presenting the idea. I think it's an important idea and complicated, but really important. So the question that I have for you is one that has been posed to me from constituents of mine on the left and, you know, kind of more in the center of the political spectrum. And their question is, how do we does the land bank structure that this bill would authorize create enough transparency, and how do we avoid excessive transaction costs in the staffing and the running of a land bank when the activity that you're undertaking is itself, you know, costly and can entail unexpected issues and needs as well?
Chairman Bernhardt, Representative Leninger, we believe as drafted, it does provide the transparency that people are looking for. The meetings would be open to the public, so decisions that are made by the land bank would have public input. The board of directors of the land bank will be made up of representatives of the local government and local community. The land bank itself will be required to prepare annual reports of its activities. One would hope that with experience, the transaction costs associated will not be excessive and not take up more than they should otherwise take up in terms of both time and revenue. That's not to say that there may not be a learning curve periodically, but again, I would think it's not necessarily different than a local government setting up any new organization or department that it's authorized to establish. There are certain initial costs. You need to hire staff. You need to make sure you have the funding to pay for them. Those costs probably can't be avoided, but I would think that there's no reason that this couldn't be as transparent and efficiently run as any other department that a local government would seek to operate.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that I've heard a great answer yet or a serious indictment of the current system we have in the state regarding brownfields, other than the fact that perhaps we haven't monetized it properly. Could you talk about that? If we simply monetized or funded what we currently are trying to do in a better fashion, why wouldn't that be a better situation, what you're advocating for here, which is the huge creation of another level of government at the local level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. Well, first of all, I think your first part of your question may be referring, if I'm, but you tell me if I'm wrong, to existing state programs for funding brownfield cleanup, and the Brownfield Coalition is supporting the recapitalization of the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund. That's another piece. It's just not before you today here, but we're certainly working to ensure that that happens, and that is definitely a vital piece of the puzzle. And if you know, we'll be happy if that happens. We'll be more happy if this happens too. I don't have a better answer than that, except to say that, as noted before, there's not a single tool that solves all the problems. More money would help. But I don't think anyone anticipates that the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund will be recapitalized at a level that would solve the brownfield problem in the state. The recommendation of the governor's budget is relatively limited, and those monies are leveraged and revolved, and they're used efficiently. And the administrator of that program is sitting in the back of the room, I believe. I haven't turned around lately, I just think, my understanding is you need lots of different approaches and lots of different tools for lots of different types of properties, and you might be able to use these tools at a local level on properties that don't rise to the level of something that the state is going to take an interest in, et cetera. So that's an attempt. But the extra level of government question, I guess, is – sorry, I smiled. Mm-hmm. But I might –
I understand you come from the metro area.
That's right. That's right. We're an efficient level of government. As David pointed out, it's not. I don't think it is much more of a cost or a transaction cost addition. Than what happens frequently at the local level, creation of new departments, creation of new advisory committees, et cetera. And in this case, the proof would be in the pudding. If there are no outcomes, I don't think anyone's going to bother. And so that's the best I can do unless David has something to add on the land bank piece, or Seth.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Could one of you address the criteria or the provision you have for additional abatements in here related to low-income housing, public park and open space, renewable energy, minority-based contracts, that sort of thing. Again, this sounds like stuff that would come from a metro area wish list. But if we talk about a state effort here, because we're talking about, you saw the map up here. We've got sites all over the state.
Right.
These are things that might ring the bell of some folks in the metro area but aren't necessarily of value and representative of Bensis District. So why should we adopt this for the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the beauty of it is that you aren't really adopting it. It's the option of the local government to do or not do that, to provide additional benefits or not, as they see fit. They could choose the one of those items that is of interest to them at the local level. They could choose none of them. They could choose all of them. Those were brought forward. As I mentioned at the beginning of the hearing, we have a very broad coalition. Those various pieces were brought forward by various members of our coalition, and we've had a really good process of hearing everyone at the table, and those are the pieces that are important to certain members of our coalition, and they're, again, they're optional at the local level, and if the local government chooses not to pursue those and chooses not to dedicate its resources, basically, it's money to those policy objectives, there's nothing requiring them to in this legislation.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would amplify just a bit. Those criteria that are in the bill also were included with the broad consensus of the coalition. Those types of items weren't just handpicked. Things that are in the bill were put out for full discussion and basically, does everybody agree that this should be in and should it be? And the things that are there where there was broad-based consensus that, yes, it makes sense to keep it, to include it. We'd like to think that that's representative of the interest, not only just in Metro, but for all representatives and members of the coalition from all parts of the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that said, we're here to hear what you have to say. And obviously, that's mm-hmm. we'd like to listen to your comments on that. I will mention that I was just referring to House Bill 2734. The other bill, the tax credit bill, includes similar elements. Those would be state dollars if the state chose to move that forward, and obviously that's something that if you're going to consider moving that bill forward, you'll want to take a look at. So that's not the local option piece. That's one where you'd be making the policy decision right here.
Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all for your testimony. Good to see you again.
Yes. Thank you, Representative.
Eddie, you guys don't have it easy. So the second time I've heard this, and I realize – perhaps you've covered, I don't understand the financing mechanism for a land bank authority once established to obtain property. So how do you pay for the actually getting title of the property?
Right. Jim Burkhardt, Representative Davis. The land bank bill provides that the land bank authority would have the ability to generate revenue as any other entity might. If they need to borrow to do it, they're authorized to do that. If they wish to issue bonds, they can do that. They can seek grant funding and financing to accomplish it. The hope is that it becomes a self-sustaining financial entity with, you know, buying low and selling high and being able to sort of cycle the funds as it moves forward. There may be an initial request from a local government for assistance in getting some initial cash. That would be something the land bank would consider and the local government would make a decision on. But put simply, they'd be in the same position that any land, anyone looking to acquire land would be in. They can acquire the capital to do it from a wide variety of mechanisms.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks. That's helpful in that it's broad. Have any governments expressed the interest in putting forth, I would assume it would have to be general funds from those entities to seed such land bank authorities so they could purchase properties? I mean, are there governments that are saying, yes, we want to do this tomorrow. Once you pass this bill, we'll forward you the $3 million check.
Chair, Representative Davis, I think I can think of some participants in the process, but I don't think I would want to put them on the record as saying they want to do this. So I think I'd rather let them come and talk to you. I don't, you know, I'm hesitant to name any particular cities, counties, or ports here.
Representative Leidinger,
thank
please.
You. So I was a county commissioner before I had this job, and I know that one of the things that our urban renewal agency did was take title to at least one brownfield site and then enter into a lease deal with a private entity that either they capped it or the county capped it, or it had been capped during a remediation process so that the entity could use it for a beneficial purpose. I guess I would love to hear your take on, and I didn't quite feel like I got the answer from the response to Representative Johnson, but why is using that expertise not better than having a new local entity do it? And it seems to me like the gap overall is it's really hard, and these are really complicated, and there are great people who work in local government, but not all of those great people have a tremendous knowledge of Superfund site remediation or compliance with that pretty arcane framework. And so how do we solve that problem? Because it seems like the main problem is super hard and hardly anybody knows how to do it. And even when you do it, sometimes it costs way more than you thought it was going to cost. I mean, we all have the political will to fix these, but the thing we don't have is, I'm not sure, a thing that we get by virtue of this good creative idea. But maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong, and I would welcome your advice on why I'm wrong.
I'll give it a shot. Chairman Burkhart, Representative Leininger. The scenario you discussed and the creation of the land bank, I don't think, are mutually exclusive. There are some municipalities and counties that will be more familiar and more comfortable with Superfund sites or state Superfund sites and may be comfortable even moving forward and understanding that the city itself is exposing its coffers to liability claims by acquiring property. And they may elect to do that. The land bank bill wouldn't preclude them from going down that very path if that's the one they chose. Then again, those very same cities could also realize that it is strategically very much in their advantage to have a separate legal entity be exposed to that liability as opposed to the city directly, and they may elect to do that. The land bank will be authorized to employ whatever staff it deems appropriate, and to the extent it wishes to hire in-house that type of expertise or contract it out to firms such as Mall Foster or others, they'd be able to do that as well. So I don't know if necessarily one is exclusive of the other. Again, it's a question of, it's another tool. There's not one tool that takes care of every brownfield property. In fact, there's some tools that may take care of that can't take care of certain brownfields, and they just become straightforward Superfund sites, and you hope at some point that they get cleaned up. But it was the consensus of the coalition that there's this broad array of properties that sort of fall in between. And there are counties and cities that have different levels of expertise and different willingness to embark on these projects, either directly or not. This provides a separate tool for them to have an indirect method of having the property be acquired, but by an entity that has the development interests and goals of the city in mind as it does it. But again, the way you proposed it, there could very well be, that could be very, the best way to go in certain circumstances, directly through the environmental department of a city or a county. It could very well be the case.
Thank you. Representative, did you have other questions? No? Oh, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to Representative Davis's question, I guess, have you been approached by any other cities or communities that have said, please pass this bill so we can create another local level of governance that we have to support with our property taxes?
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart, Representative Johnson. As a consultant, I work with numerous public agencies around the state, including in districts that some of the committee members represent. One in particular is the city of Beaverton, and I'm helping them to implement a brownfield program, partially funded through the US EPA brownfield grant program. And, you know, again, not to put anyone at that city on the record, they are actively engaged in the coalition. They've helped to craft these bills, and they are looking forward to implementing some cleanup through hopefully incentivized processes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have several questions, and most of them aren't really related directly to the revenue issues, so I apologize for that. But one of the things you said early on was that this would be a mechanism through which brownfield ownership could be consolidated. That interests me a bit, and I have to say I don't know very much about brownfields. Do we have a bunch of brownfields in areas where this mechanism might be used? Where consolidating them because they're in multiple ownerships would be of benefit in the process of cleanup and reutilization?
Just a short answer, Chair Barnhart. 2 years ago, the Port of Portland commissioned a study on industrial land availability, and they found that of the three main challenges to locating industrial, shovel-ready industrial land in the state, one of those was parcelization. So there's available industrial land, but it's chopped up under multiple ownership. So to the extent that the land bank could help address that, it's hugely important, yes.
I'm assuming some of it belongs to heirs of long-dead industrialists who are scattered all around the world at this point.
Very likely, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Some questions about the board and other related issues. This board, I assume, comes under public meeting laws because it's a municipal corporation in this bill. Is that correct?
I believe you're right.
I believe that's correct. Yes.
I mean, you
Chairman.
Indicated that it was subject to public meeting laws, and there's nothing in the bill that says that. Is there something in the bill that talks about the resolutions and papers being public records?
I'm sorry. Oh, public meeting laws versus the public record. Well, it says I'm looking at page 3, lines 3-7, and yes, you're right. It doesn't specifically mention public meeting law, so that's probably something that would need to be addressed. I mean, I think the intent is that this is public.
My suspicion, and I'd like to know the answer to that, my suspicion is that it is subject to public meeting laws because it's defined earlier in the same in the bill as a municipal corporation. I think that brings it in, but I'm not certain.
Right. That is the intent, Mr. Chair.
Right. Thank you. I'm wondering why you established a self-perpetuating board with potentially unlimited length of office.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it is unlimited. I think each of the board chairs is for the positions are for 4 years.
4 years, and they're subject to reappointment. There's no limitation on the reappointment authority, so there could be an unlimited term of office by reappointment every 4 years. The appearance of the way it's written, it would suggest that the board itself makes those appointments. The initial board is set up by the governing body that established the organization in the first place. But then after that, it's the board that appoints. I'm curious about why it's self-perpetuating, and whether that there may be a value. I don't know. It just seems odd to me. And that's something you may want to look into before answering. Yeah. Finally, there's a section later on about liability, the lack of liability for spills and other things that are coming off of the property. Again, I have only vague recollection of these laws. It's not something I've worked in. Is someone else liable for those kinds of things, like the previous owner or series of owners? How does that get cleaned up and managed if you have an oil spill that runs off of the property into a river or stream or onto someone else's property?
Chairman Barnhart, the purpose of that provision is simply to make explicit that the land bank itself, by acquiring Parcel A, doesn't acquire liability should the contaminants that are on Parcel A, through no fault or activity of the land bank, migrate to Parcel B. Any other liable entities, prior owners, prior operators, they're still on the hook, and obviously the cleanup costs associated with Parcel B, those entities could be looked to. This is just to essentially make sure that the liability exemption of that applies to the land bank doesn't prove to be prophylactic, given that it is fairly common where contaminants beginning on one parcel can migrate to another, especially if they're in groundwater. So it's just to ensure that there's no exposure to claims for contamination in Parcel B,
right,
acquiring Parcel A. But all other potentially liable parties would still be subject to claims by other parties for the contamination, both at A as well as B, and any other parcel that runs
through. Were these issues discussed in the earlier committees? I don't want to redo their work, but if...
I don't believe that this question was raised before, Mr. Chairman.
One of the things that I wonder about then is the way in which we go about collecting from prior owners in the event of a contamination that somebody should be liable for. If you have transferred something of value in return for the property, I wonder if that ought to be in the appropriate case ought to be subject to offset, held in an escrow account or something, in order to pay for that possible contamination, rather than simply transfer to the previous owner. I frankly don't know enough about how this stuff works to know whether that's even a sensible idea or not, but it's something that occurs to me. I think there's some unanswered questions, is what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, if I can just understand your question. So is your concern that, for instance, if the land bank pays money to the property owner, that money should always be held in escrow for any claims against a prior property owner?
I'm not suggesting that ought to happen. I'm simply suggesting that would be a mechanism through which you could keep that prior property owner liable for those kinds of accidents if the municipal corporation we're setting up isn't liable.
Mr. Chair, the bill itself doesn't change the liability picture for anybody else.
Correct.
So the prior property owner remains a liable party even though they've sold the property. And they remain a liable property owner to the city and to any other third party where that contamination may run. They remain liable to the state and potentially to the federal government if those parcels need to be cleaned up using state or federal dollars. So the prior property owner doesn't get a hall pass just because they've sold the property. That exemption only applies
to... And, of course, that's not my question. We're talking about the practical aspect of collecting.
Oh, well.
Right, well... Chair Barnhart,
one of the things about this committee you need to understand is we deal with reality, not legal fiction. And it's wonderful to have the idea that a prior owner is liable. It's another thing to actually collect.
Mr. Chair, I in 25 years of Superfund litigation, I am well aware of the trials and tribulations of collecting from prior owners. I'm also well aware of mechanisms by which you can get to their old insurance policies, you can get to their old assets, all of which remain available. That may not help the immediate problem when that person sells, or if the party has no money initially or appears to have no money. Litigation certainly will be the most likely mechanism for that. I would say that probably exists whether you have a land bank or not.
Probably true. Thank you. That's a very good answer, and I appreciate it. And it illustrates, again, why I apologized before asking the question, because it is an area that I know very little about. I think the key point for this committee having this bill has to do with the later parts of the bill and the property tax abatement issue. And I understand you have some amendments you're bringing for that, so I'm not going to go into the questions I have for that area. Do my questions prompt any others? Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mr.
And a very thorough presentation.
Mr. Chair, I'll bring you draft amendments soon so you can at least see what they look like.
I appreciate that.
They're very similar structurally to what exists now, except for the mechanism itself.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Jody Weiser or Marcia Kelly? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on these two bills? Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, it's probably no surprise that we're skeptical about this bill. Brownfields definitely are a problem, and revitalization does a lot for both the economic and the health outcomes.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, Jody Weiser.
And while you're at it, we have two bills open. Would you tell us which bill you're referring to?
I'm actually speaking to both bills.
Thank you.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So you really only need to look at the map that's on the Portland Brownfields Program site to see what has happened to some brownfields since 1998, since that program began, and the state has a similar loan program. So we like the idea of the land bank authority, because there'll probably be some instances where that makes sense to have a part of the government that's actually working specifically on that kind of issue, because it's probably hard to get your resources to go there when you have 1,000 different topics in front of you like this committee does and any city would have. We are worried about the transparency element of it. It calls for one meeting a year, and they could be dealing with millions and millions of dollars. And so I think that there's questions about that. But the legislation for both bills provide no structure to analyze really the amount of subsidy that an individual project should get. And saying that you're going to get 75 or 100% of the cost of doing something to increase the value of your own property is pretty extravagant, actually. Randy Tucker mentioned that the local option doesn't have impact on the state's budget, but of course it does, since the school funding formula gives us that. So one of the bills, 2289, would get all of the money from the state, and the other one would get someplace between 30 and 56% of the money from the state, depending upon what their contribution is to the school funding formula. We do have programs. We have state programs and we have local programs that are funded with state money and with federal money, and they're loan programs except for the grants that help analyze the problem. But obviously that isn't making all land get fixed up. And partly that's because the owner has no particular reason to. I think I probably, until I sold it, owned a piece of brownfield property myself. Because he had a farm, you know, and farms all had gas tanks once upon a time.
Right.
We do think that for the most part the revolving loan idea is best, because it actually is related to the cost of a project's being cleaned up. But a revolving loan program won't solve every problem because sometimes the contamination is way more expensive to repair than the property will be worth once that it has been repaired. If you look at the chart that I provided, you can see, however, why we have some concerns. Suppose that any one of us purchased a property that once had a dry cleaners, a car repair shop, a gas station, a plating facility, some industrial use that caused damage for $30,000. And when we were finished remediating the property, it was going to be worth $300,000. Well, if you remediate it and you get 75% of your subsidy of subsidy, either because you get a property tax abatement or because you hired a nominally woman-owned business to do at least 50% of the cleanup cost, then actually the owner of the property would have put $55,000 into the property. The public would have put $75,000 into the property, but it would be the property owner that got the $300 sales price. So the public's not getting a particularly good return on investment, but it's great if you're that property owner. If the cost of remediation was $300,000 instead, the owner of the property is going to invest $105,000 and get $300,000. Even if the cost is $600,000, it's a great investment with a wonderful return. In fact, it takes something like a $2 million remediation process to see where it's actually clear that public subsidy is needed.
Could you wrap up for us?
Yes.
We have another hearing to hold, and I know we only have 20 minutes or so at the most for that.
So somehow the bill needs to be, both bills would need to be changed so that we're not providing a gift to the first three property owners, and we're actually considering whether it's worth investing $2 million in, or $1.5 million in tax credits or property tax exemption in the fourth sample. Somebody needs to be looking at it, and that's why the land authority makes some sense. But the bill, either bill, needs a lot more detail in how much subsidy goes towards the cost of the project in relationship to what will be earned from the sale of it, rather than just that you get this percentage. And so those would be our major concern with the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, and I'll try to be very, very brief. When I saw the term brownfields, I thought, oh, I seem to remember something about some other research that I'd done, and I went back to the New Market Tax Credits. In the presentation, the proponents haven't really talked a great deal about other monies available through the Fed. So if you look at the EPA page and see what kinds of pilot program for area-wide planning, assessment grants, revolving loan funds, cleanup grants, workforce development grants, and then you also look at one of their suggestions is using New Market Tax Credits, which is not necessarily my favorite subject, but using New Market Tax Credits because there are some advantages for people who are doing brownfield, and one of them is that they're often willing to structure a more favorable deal than traditional lending institutions for brownfield properties. And there are three or four other things that the EPA on their funding brownfield says. I do realize that our state New Market Tax Credits are fully subscribed, but there are other community development entities that do New Market Tax Credits. So I'm thinking that maybe rather than doing especially an income tax credit, that we should look at some other options out there for funding before we decide handing any more of our state tax credit dollars, because it is apparent there are.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2289 and House Bill 2734 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3199.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, House Bill 3199 is a residual or a leftover from the time of the university system going on, it's on, being spun off, I guess, by government. However, if you see the House, the bill itself, you would find a lot of blanks and open spots, which tells you that there is still some work to be done on this. We have a group from different parts of the government interested in the issues in order to conclude it, and they would like to address you about their latest work on this level.
Thank you, and I appreciate it very much, and thank you for your patient waiting during the previous complex issues. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. To the chair, my name is Laura Lockhart-Call. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division in the Oregon State Treasury. With me at the table today are various participants who've been working with us as we've been, this is a work in progress, as Mr. As Mazin mentioned. We are actively working on putting together bond transactions for universities as we speak, and we did a refunding back in February, and we're learning as we are trying to now issue bonds for universities in the new governance structure that there are some gaps in state law that we're trying to work through together. There may be some university people here as well today. And so we had a placeholder bill back in January at the SDPAC meeting, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission meeting. I discussed that we were struggling with some of these statutory gaps and that we would like, once we worked out sort of administrative machinery, we would come back to you with a game plan. That game plan is still evolving. The Dash 1 amendments weren't ready for today's hearing. So if it's with the pleasure of the chair, I have several people to talk about conceptually what we'd like to do. The universities have looked at our concept, and they have some modifications to our concept. So what we hope to do is when we do come to you with the Dash 1 amendments, hopefully it's a consensus product. But we need to get the ball rolling if we're going to hit the goal line of having something in place by the end of the session. So with that, the big picture things that we discovered, Senate Bill 270 in 2013 created this process to start breaking the universities into independent institutions with individual boards of regents or trustees for each school. The three larger universities became independent on July 1st, 2014. However, and they do have revenue bond authority, but we've continued to authorize through the bond bill bond issues issued under Article 11 F and G of our state constitution to sell bonds for various projects at their schools. So what you should think of, and I have lawyers to talk more about some of the legal constructs we're creating, but we're still selling these bonds, but now we're the credit enhancer. So we're selling them with our credit rating, our state credit rating, and in some cases we're handing over money that's more in the form of a grant, which are the, you'll hear more about in detail, the 11G, where there's a 50% match by the schools. In some cases, these are self-supporting revenue bonds under Article 11F. Think of those as loans, because they're repaying the debt. So many of the things we're doing are technical, administrative, budget, legal. There is one issue that perhaps universities and the treasurer's office won't agree on. And so I just want to point out there will be some policy issues when you see the bill. And it's really for the legislature and the governor's office to determine. But Treasury does have a point of view. And that's in the case of 11F. We'll come back to it another time, but full disclosure, there's not agreement. And that is that there's a requirement for a revenue sufficiency test for these now are called loan agreements. Mm-hmm. And just put in the back of your mind, but the question is, can we really predict if we sell bonds for school that they will have sufficient revenues to repay that debt over the next 25 or 30 years? And that test in the Constitution is pretty important. Historically, Treasury relied upon the Chancellor's Office, their budget staff, to do the vetting and to go through the analysis, make sure that the whole operations worked as well as the specifics of the project. And at the back end, in 286A.010, Treasury still has a responsibility at the end of the day to make sure the cash flows are there. The goal here is to not have those projects hit our general fund capacity. The goal is those are self-supporting. In the New World Order, each school will certify that they have sufficiency. But this is an example where you're having the lendee certify to the lendor without a check. And so one of the things Treasury would like the legislature to consider as we look at this bill is whether there should be somebody vetting the project at the front end who has deep expertise in higher education operations. I don't have that, My staff doesn't have that. And by the time we see it, it's 2 years after someone's approved a bit, and people would be pretty upset if we said no. And so one of the things in the bill that, you know, will have to be thought through is whether another party should have that responsibility. We've theoretically proposed that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, since they're putting together the budgets of the schools and they know a lot about it, could serve in the capacity that the Chancellor's Office served in. If they're not the right body, I suggest that either LFO or DAS, maybe the right parties. But that, and so that, I just need to point out, you know, a lot of this other stuff is tactical administrative budget. This is pure policy. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to people who've been working on the bill to talk about their parts of that. And to my immediate right is Cynthia Burns from Department of Justice. And she'll be talking first about the state law context. We have Chris Reynolds, who's from our bond counsel shop, Ora Carrington Sutcliffe, who gives our legal opinions, and then Jean Gabriel from DAS, who has a monumental task of actually administering the bond programs going forward.
All right, and I apologize for the lack of time, but I would like to move through this in about 10 minutes and give Mr. Bernard a chance to give his points. Let me ask you first two questions. Timing question, when do you need some resolution by the legislature of this issue? Do you need it this session? And if I'm getting head nods, if that's the case, then the second question answers itself. We got to have that amendment right away.
Through the chair, we're not a yes because we have temporary authority to expend bond proceeds through, I think it was Senate Bill 5543, which gave DAS unlimited expenditure authority to disperse bond proceeds. So we're going to sell bonds in June, and DAS can disperse bond proceeds for project costs through June 30th. On June 30th, that authority disappears, and in the absence of any new authority, we don't have a mechanism to expend to disperse bond proceeds. So we do want to get it done, but we also are sensitive to want to make sure that the universities are comfortable with the structure and arrangement. So good note is it's still an LC. We were hoping it'd be ready today, but it does give us a chance to take their comments into consideration and try as best as we can to reach consensus on one document to give you, with maybe a few caveats where we disagree.
Okay, thank you. May I suggest that you and the universities may find it prudent to work over the weekend and get this done, because we're getting it through the House to the Senate, where you get to explain it all again, and then out to off the floor before June 30th will be a trick at this stage.
If I may, through the chair, I forgot to mention that LFO has also been part of our process and has offered, if necessary, to get it over to Capital Construction Ways and Means, if that helps in the time frame.
That may be the approach, although I don't think this is a Capital Construction Ways and Means issue, although maybe the Speaker differs with me about that. I don't know. Is this a subsequent referral?
It doesn't.
I think that probably the normal pattern, if we're not in an emergency, would be to pass it over the House floor and send it to Finance and Revenue.
We are open to any and all opportunities and
suggestions. The other possibility is something that could happen if we were stuck. But if June 30th is our deadline, most of us are hoping the House adjourns before then.
Me too.
All right. Please, go ahead.
Mr.
I'm sorry. Representative Blitzett.
Would there be a way to put this into shared services somehow, an expansion?
They're going to talk about some of that,
I think.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, as Laura said, I'm Cynthia Burns with the Attorney General's Office. I'm not here to advocate for or against the bill. I'm here as the attorney who represents the state treasurer and many other state agencies in the state's bonding programs. So I'll try to be quick, just a little bit of background about how we got here and where we are. As you all know, OUS has been a state agency, and even after some of the legislation that freed it from many state contracting and other restrictions, it continued to be a state agency. And so we continue to use the same bond disbursement processes and things that we did for all other state agencies. With the changes and the sort of breakup of the university system last legislative session, That framework changed, and there were some statutes put in place that established a framework for debt repayment under which the universities are given a schedule that says how much debt they have to pay for the state bonds that are outstanding, and also requires them to enter into an agreement with the treasurer that talks about the timings and mechanics of some of how those monies come into the state and then get paid out to the bondholders. In the process of doing that agreement, we confronted some issues, or some issues started to come to the forefront that made this the current situation different than OUS. And one of the fundamental differences now is that for contracting purposes and sort of treatment of legal agreements, the universities are treated as a separate legal entity. Before, DOJ had said we were doing everything under interagency agreements. So now they're really a different legal party, and we put agreements in place that have enforceable rights and remedies and things like that. And so as we were going through this process with the debt agreements and beginning to work on the bond sales that are coming up, we realized that we sort of had the debt repayment structure covered, but there wasn't a very good structure in place for dispersing bond proceeds and going forward. And as we worked on trying to put agreements in place, at least I came to the realization of is the model that we were ending up with was something that's very similar to bond programs that are out there for other agencies already, where DAS as an is that agency that has sort of the expertise in tracking debt payments and tax compliance issues and things like that. But there's a program agency that receives the bond proceeds and enters into a grant agreement or a loan agreement, depending on the program, where it sends those monies out the door to another legal entity, and embedded in that agreement is requirements that they use the property or the proceeds in a way that protects the tax-exempt status of the state bonds that were issued and things like that. Well, generally, then, the agencies who are sending those monies out the door have expenditure authority in their budget related to sending that money out. Well, we discovered that there really wasn't a process like that in put in place to send monies to the universities. So that's really the intent of this bill, and it's modeled on the existing programs that are out there for 11Q bonds, for seismic bonds, for the state improvement bonds, where there's an agency, in this case it would be HEC, that has the expenditure authority and is really the agency that signs the grant agreement or the loan agreement. And then DAS, who has the expertise in sort of tracking some of the tax compliance issues and debt and things like that, would really work on the bond administration portion of the program. So that's pretty much all I have. That's the purpose of the bill.
Suddenly I understand why the capital construction referral might be the appropriate one. Please, go ahead.
Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Christine Reynolds. I am here in my capacity as bond counsel to the state of Oregon for the Article 11F and Article 11G bond programs. I'm an attorney at Ora, Carrington, and Sutcliffe in Portland. The proposed amendments, as you've heard Laura and Cynthia describe, are intended to address gaps that have been identified as the state has gone through the process of issuing bonds this year for the purposes of the programs authorized under the Constitution. As Cynthia just noted, the proposed amendments that were prepared are modeled on existing state statutes for the 11Q bonds and the seismic bonds, and are in this case specific to the public universities, intended to make sure that we are complying with the state constitutional requirements for issuing F bonds and G bonds, shorthand, and also meeting the federal tax requirements. As bond counsel to the state, one of the important roles we play as legal counsel is making sure that the bonds are compliant with legal requirements so we can deliver our unqualified legal opinion to the bond market, which is necessary for the state to sell bonds and get favorable interest rates and have good terms on the bonds. To do that, we need to be sure that there is compliance. And so part of the provisions of the proposed amendments expressly provide for a mechanism to do that by providing reference and definitions and in statutory provisions to make sure that the required matching amount for 11G bonds, so that we know that the universities are providing their 50% match of monies that are available for the same or similar purpose for the bonds that the state has authorized, the legislature has authorized to be issued. And in the case of Article 11F bonds, which are essentially being loaned to the universities since they are paying the debt service on those bonds. The Constitution does require, as Laura mentioned, that the constructing authority, in this case the public universities, provide a conservative estimate that there are revenues sufficient to pay the debt service on the bonds and to operate the project for the life of the bonds. So in each of those cases, we need to be sure that before the state issues the bonds and we deliver our legal opinion, that those constitutional requirements have been met. So the draft proposed amendment would help put a framework around that so that the state and the universities have a reference point of what they need to do to comply with those constitutional requirements that were approved by the voters. In addition to that, the other element that's important is the federal tax law compliance. And again, those grant and loan contracts that would be entered into will provide for tax compliance provisions to be sure that the public universities provide the state the information that's necessary to comply with federal tax laws, because even though the universities will be getting the benefit of the proceeds of the bonds, the state is the issuer of the bonds, the state's name is on those bonds, and in the event that the IRS has any questions about those bonds during the life of them, they're going to come knock on the door of the state. They're not going to come knock on the door of any of the public universities to begin with, but the public universities are operating the projects, and they're the ones that are going to have all the information that the state is going to need to answer the questions the IRS might have about any private use. So any private company that might be using a portion of a room of one of the buildings, the state needs to have procedures in place to be sure we understand what that private use is and to go get information from the universities when needed to make sure that that is going forward in an appropriate manner. That's the thumbnail sketch. And I'm always available and happy to answer any questions that any members of the committee would have.
I personally find that extremely clear and useful. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Jean Gabriel, the Capital Finance Manager with the Department of Administrative Services. As my colleagues have alluded to, I think it's very important to establish a state agency as a responsible party to administer these bond programs to ensure compliance with the federal tax rules to protect the state's bond programs. Since DAFS already has a capital finance unit with a manager and two technical staff, we felt that it made sense to have DAFS administer the 11F and 11G bond programs. DAFS already administers the 11Q bond programs and several others. While we will be asking for additional resources to handle this workload, it's more of an incremental add rather than trying to have to stand up an entirely new unit in another state agency that has no prior knowledge of bond financing, which is a fairly technical area. Yeah. We're proposing to have DAFS function as the bond program administrator and have the Higher Education Coordinating Commission function as what we call the project agency. HEC would disperse the bond proceeds to the universities pursuant to grant agreements and loan agreements between HEC and the individual universities. Those agreements would be subject to DAS approval so that with our knowledge and experience, we could ensure that those agreements had all the necessary provisions that Chris was mentioning. This would include provisions that would allow DAS to track interest earnings, track when proceeds are considered spent under the tax code, and restrict the use of the proceeds and the use of the financed assets. So DAS would basically be in an oversight role to ensure that we can protect the tax-exempt status of the bonds. HEC would account for the debt, budget and pay the debt service on the state's bonds, and they would collect the loan repayments from the universities and use that to pay the debt service. HEC would process the reimbursement requests, they would review the invoices from the universities and ensure that the proceeds were spent on allowable project costs. DAS would manage the actual project accounts, we would take care of closing out the project accounts timely and transfer the unspent balances to the debt service fund. We would also monitor those debt service funds. So all of this is monitoring in association with ensuring the tax compliance. And as Laura mentioned, another function that we feel is appropriate for HEC is to handle the review of the revenue sufficiency of the universities on the projects funded with 11F bonds. And while these bonds are technically liabilities of the state, they're not liabilities of the university, the Constitution requires that the constructing authority, which is in this case the universities, estimate that there are sufficient revenues to repay the debt on the bond. So, you know, as part of the loan agreements, we'll ask the universities to provide those cash flow projections. And at the end of the day, it's the state that's going to be on the hook if the revenues are short. And so we feel it's appropriate and it's prudent for the state through HEC to do some due diligence on those estimates and review the reasonableness of those projections. So one of the big advantages of having the debt accounted for in HIC is to align the debt service expenditures in the program area instead of being in the administration area, which is the area that DAS has its budget in. And along those same lines, the governor's budget proposed moving the debt service for the OHSU opportunity bonds from DAS to HIC. And OHSU also has a debt payment agreement between OUS and OHSU. And as you know, the OUS is going to be dissolved effective July 1. And so in some fashion or another, either in Senate Bill 80 or in this bill, somehow we need to replace that party that's going away in that payment arrangement, whether it be HEC or DAS or whomever. So that's basically all I
wanted
to
say. So one of the things that DAS would do would be the ongoing monitoring that Bond Council referred to that maintains the our relationship, appropriate relationship with the Internal Revenue Service.
Chair Barnhart, yes, that is correct.
Thank
we
you.
We do that monitoring.
Briefly, other questions? Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yes, I was wondering what kind of charges would DAS be imposing on overseeing this? Because that's one of the things I've started to notice. DAS charges incredible amounts of money, like to oversee computer systems, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars and for lots of things. So what kind of money are we looking at that DAS would be charging?
And I'll simply note, of course, that would be an issue of prime concern to the Capital Construction Subcommittee of Ways
okay.
and Means.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, the types of charges that we're talking about here are primarily associated with the actual bond issuance. So we would be looking at things like legal fees, bond counsel fees, underwriter's discount, all those kinds of fees that are associated with issuance. And what the normal process is to issue bonds for those called cost of issuance so that when you issue, you have those monies available. So those dollar amounts that are cost of issuance, they would not be charged to the universities. However, this, in order for the state to manage its bond programs, not only through DAS, but also through the role that treasurer plays in managing our relationships with the credit agencies, and you know, managing the issuance process for all the state's bond programs, there are some assessments that do need to be charged out in order to have staffing resources for DAS and for Treasury as well. And I think I'll let Laura
if I could
speak
could
to
add,
her.
Through the chair, just to further clarify, there are upfront costs, as Jean has mentioned, at the time of issuance, and DAS chooses to bundle up a lot of their ongoing costs in one lump sum up front. Treasury has a smaller fee just on the cost of doing it, but we do ongoing work, and my whole budget of my whole division is an annual allocation to every debt issuing agency in the state and is spread out, and so there's quarterly charges. We're not talking about huge amounts of money to any one entity in that regard, but there are ongoing arbitrage rebate. And then there's times when universities, for example, or other entities have changes of use. I'm looking at a project right now with Portland State where they bought something 10 years ago and now they want to do something else. We have four or five different sets of bond issues, either new money or refundings, and we have to hire tax attorneys to do the research as to how we go about refinancing that debt. And so there will be some things that are one-offs. And so it's difficult to say with absolute certainty every year what everyone will pay. But no one would be paying more than everybody else is already paying for all the other debt issuing agencies
right.
for the ongoing services that we provide.
Right. That means these are services you're already providing for the OUS.
And if we didn't charge the universities, for example, for my agency's costs,
right.
then we'd have to charge everybody else
That's right.
more
so
for that.
If just a quick
yeah,
follow-up.
Yeah, and if make it really fast, because I want to make certain we hear from Hans and several of us at a 3 o'clock meeting.
I just wanted to ask if this was formerly covered under the chancellor's budget.
Through the chair, yes, absolutely. Every aspect of this was. I wanted to say you did ask about shared services, and I think it's important just to mention briefly. Initially, everyone thought shared services could do the job. The thing about shared services, it's an entity that's an agreement between the seven universities, voluntary, they can leave that, and they're not a state agency. And at the end of the day, we issue the bonds, and we think we need a state agency to protect a state's interests. The Treasurer's Office is interested in protecting the state's credit rating, its good name with investors, and obviously, ultimately, the general fund. And if things go awry, we feel like it's important that a state agency be sitting more in the driver's seat.
Thank you. And while Mr. Bernard is coming up to talk, I'll simply note that I think what we've heard from Bond Council is that not only are those things important, but also the Constitution requires a mechanism similar to the one that you're describing in order to comply with our constitutional authority to borrow money. Please. And I apologize for the short amount of time that we have today, but I thought it's important to at least let you get a couple of words in.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. I appreciate the time, and I think having very little of it is probably just fine. I'm here today on behalf of all the seven public universities. We're sort of coordinating our responses to bills, and I've been put on point for this lucky task. We'd like to put on the record today as it regards to House Bill 3199. While we are in a different legal position than the state treasury, we do not believe that a state agency is needed to disperse bond proceed debt payments. We have a disagreement legal interpretation of the law on that point. It is not a point where the universities would choose to spend a lot of energy arguing the issue. We think that if the state treasury feels it would be more elegant, more convenient, more appropriate to have a state agency tasked with that responsibility, we can certainly see benefits to working out that relationship. We do want to make sure that the arrangements that are put in place are ones that do not create significant layers of administrative burden that are unnecessary for universities. If there are due diligence activities going on campus with the boards of trustees as they are engaged in their financial management of the institutions or within shared services, we believe that the institutions, shared services, the boards of trustees should be able to work out financial agreements with Treasury to ensure compliance with the postage students compliance issues that Treasury will have to certify. That said, we can say only positive things about our working relationship with State Treasury over the last several months as it relates to the bond sales that have gone on under the authority that was granted by this legislature with the passage of the rebalance bill and the temporary language that was included in Senate Bill 5543. We have encountered numerous areas where we have had to work through technical issues and believe that we can continue to do that. I think that we can work with the Legislative Council, State Treasury, the universities, our bond council, come back to you with some agreements that either are consensus agreements or certainly 99% consensus agreements. I do believe, and I believe as the conversation today has shown, this is an issue that certainly has relevance in the capital construction conversation. So if that creates a faster path for the bill as it needs to move through the process, depending on where we end up, we certainly are comfortable with that. I would note just that to be humane to Legislative Council, the drafter who is tasked with drafting these issues is also tasked with dealing with ethics and public records law, so there was a significant workload addition in the middle of session. So some of the reason that we are here today is because for a variety of politically and policy important reasons, a lot of other issues took back burner while those staff dealt with those issues for a time during this session.
We're not going to have time for questions today, but let me simply note that I appreciate the university's position that they would prefer to keep as streamlined as possible. But also your agreement that if the state considers it more elegant to pursue the course that's already been outlined, that you'll accede to that. I think that's what you said, and I appreciate it.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, we certainly understand and agree that it may be in the prudent for the state to have a state agency in administering these bond proceeds and payments. I think the devil is in the details and ensuring that institutions can continue to effectively manage their institutions and the boards of trustees can operate with the authorities that were vested in them by this legislature last session.
So let me close with this. The process of doing the kind of major changes that we've made in institutional structure that we started, what, about 4 years ago, is something that is not going to be completed with this bill.
Correct.
Nor will it be completed in the next session or the one after that. Mm-hmm. So if we're close and we accomplish the needs of the universities to be able to issue bonds and the treasurer to be able to vouch for them appropriately so that they actually can be issued, I think we will accomplish a lot, even if we all agree that there are still nits to be picked and kinks to be pulled out. And thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Absolutely.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2199. In committee, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.